The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I'm really excited for this one because it combines my two loves, football and wine. Yes, I'm 45. I'm Peter Pan. Those are the two things of my life. joined now by Drew Bledsoe, the founder, the vintner for Double Back Wines. Drew, really appreciate you joining the show.
Yeah, man. My pleasure, man. It's you and I. I don't know how many of us there are out there in the world that share these common interests of football and wine. A lot of people don't think those things go together, but I think there's more of us than you might think that that are, you know, football loving wine geeks.
Yeah. And actually, you know what, let's start there. How different is wine culture in the NFL now versus when you got drafted in the early 90s? Because it feels like I see it more on the NBA side, where wine is becoming a bit more of a status symbol today than it was, you know, back in your first couple of years in the league.
Yeah, sure. You know, I think there are a couple of things happening. You know, one is that, first of all, you know, guys are making even more money now. So it's like, okay, we might as well drink something that's a little more sophisticated. It has at least a perception of, you know, some elevated sophistication to it. But it's also, I think that there's just more knowledge out there now than there was when, you know, back in the early 90s. You know, in the early 90s, if you wanted to learn about wine, you know, remember, this is just at the very inception of the internet. You know, I mean, you actually had to go get a book. I mean, God forbid, you had to get a book and like read real words on a real page if you wanted to learn about wine, or you had to go, you know, to find your guy at your local wine shop that could teach you about wine. Well, now the information is so readily available that I think it's made it a lot more accessible to more people. I do really, one of the trends that we have seen, and I think you probably have witnessed this, is that has really changed since the early 90s, is that the athletes that are getting into the wine business now are actually really serious about making good wine. You know, in the early 90s, you know, it was sort of what this was my perception. I think this was actually true. Most of the jocks that got into wine, it was just taking somebody's like third or fourth label and slapping their name on it, like an endorsement deal, and putting it out there. And it was mostly shit wine.
Yeah.
Guys that are getting into, or people that are getting into the wine business, are at least making a strong attempt at making high quality wine rather than just the endorsement side of things.
Were you nervous when you were starting to dip your toes and get into it? And we'll talk about Double Back Winery and about the joy of Washington State in a moment. But were you nervous that you wouldn't be taken seriously, that people would look at you in that same way?
100%. It was something that we really focused on at the inception of the winery. And honestly, it was a big driver for the name Double Back. Rather than, you know, Bledsoe. Now we have Bledsoe Family Winery now also, which is our second winery, and we have Bledsoe McDaniels, but that's been through a long, you know, decade plus of kind of rebranding myself as a wine guy rather than the football guy. When we launched, we were very intentional about not putting Bledsoe on the front of the bottle. I actually had a disagreement with my winemaker at the time, about using, you know, Bledsoe on the front of the bottle. And I said, well, in my take was, well, okay, that might work in the near term and get somebody to buy one bottle, but if we want people to really understand what this project is about and understand the authenticity of it and you know, how serious we are about the wine, they have to believe in the wine first. And then if they like the football story, great. But if they don't believe wholeheartedly in the wine and in the product first and foremost, then we're not going to have them for a long time.
Yeah. Anyone who is a Pats fan might buy bottle number one from you, but if they don't like it, they're not buying bottle number 2 through 12.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the other part of that is that, if people are buying it as a trophy, well, then they never drink it, Mm-hmm. And let's be honest, man, I mean, I love wine and we have in our cellar. I bet I have 8 bottles in my cellar that will never be consumed. They're just trophies. But other than that, everything else in our cellar, we intend to consume, right? And I bristle at these cellars that you see with all these wines that are just trophies that people aren't going to ever consume. Not the business we're in. We want people, maybe put it in the cellar for a few years, but eventually we want people to actually drink the wine. And so if people are just, trophy hunters for an athlete that they liked back in the day, then they just put it on the shelf and it just becomes a trophy, and we don't want that.
Okay, I have to ask, the 8 that you're not going to touch, do you reveal that? Now I'm wildly curious. Is some old wine that you got at an auction?
No, it's more personal than that. So, for example, my wife and I got to spend some time with Michael Mondavi when we were down in Napa the one time, and we stayed at the Mondavi estate. And he went down into the cellar and he grabbed bottles with our birth years and handed those to us, specifically. And so it's like, okay, Michael Mondavi gave us this Mondavi reserve from our birth years. And we just put those in. Then I have found one of my friends whose dad started one of the very, very early wines in the Willamette Valley in Oregon, Willa Kinsey, it's called. I found a bottle of their inaugural vintage, which I think was like 74, 76, something like that. And that wine, it's cool because it's my buddy's winery. But I also look at it and there's a lot of head space, I'm sure the wine's just not very good.
Yeah.
First of all, so that becomes a trophy. Then I've got, bottle number 1 of Doubleback. I mean, when am I going to drink that? So some of those kinds of things. So it's more sentimental than value driven. There are some, bottles that are worth a ton, but I still intend to drink those someday. But the trophy ones that won't get consumed, those are highly personal.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That makes total sense. I didn't know if it was, this was a bottle, not Richard Jefferson. Now that's the sports side. President Thomas Jefferson, the Koch brothers, I was just checking. Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's cool. That's absolutely cool. Yeah. So I want to sort of bounce back and forth to your journey and a whole bunch of things. I read this quote from Ted Johnson. And I guess for the listeners, I need to explain who that is. A great linebacker, played with Drew back in the day in New England. And he said, we'd go out to dinners and he was going to order the wine and it was going to be this whole process. I'm curious, back in those days, did you feel pressure to get the right bottle, or were your teammates not that fussy?
Well, they weren't that fussy because I was also paying dinner. So they really didn't old Ted, I love Ted, but I'm not sure he's ever found his wallet. it was one of those where I didn't know very much, but I knew more than they did. And wine lists are always interesting because, once you have at least a certain level of wine acumen, what you're looking for on a restaurant wine list, you're looking for something that, you don't have to pay an arm and a leg for, but is still going to go well with your dinner. I think there's when we first got into it, I just go to the most expensive bottle. They're like, here, we'll just have the expensive one. It was generally good, but it wasn't necessarily super well thought out. As we started to get a little bit more knowledgeable, you're like, okay, let me see if I can find something that's not going to break the bank, especially with the football guys. Cause you can probably imagine they drink quite a bit of wine. So, you start paying $400 a bottle, those start to add up really, really quickly and become a very big number.
And the worst part isn't even the economic part. It's the, wait a minute, guys, are you appreciating what you're drinking?
Right.
You're just, for you, it's just a unit of, it's just a measurement of liquid alcohol that you're consuming.
Yes. And that was when that was another reason that I would go to, try to find the hidden gem on the wine list, because I wanted something that I was going to enjoy, but that these guys that, you know, were mixing it with 7-Up weren't going to completely just make me super angry. But you'd be surprised though. there were more guys than you would think that actually were paying attention and were actually trying to, you know, appreciate the wine.
Yeah. I'd love to go back to 2007. This quote with some of your early days, you were talking about how your kids actually helped plant vines with us back in 2007. What were the early days like for you in Washington State with Double Back?
You know, it was, well, let's see, the first few things that come to mind when you say that, hold on, I was just actually going to, you're hosting this, so I can't share. I was going to show you a picture too. Kind of cool, but
I would have no idea how to do that.
I think you have to make me a host, and then I was going to show you some pictures. But I guess that doesn't work for a podcast anyway. You know, the first things that come to mind when you ask what the early days were like for us as we got into the business, the first thing that comes to mind is that it seemed like every day that I was in the business, I found out something new that I didn't even know I was supposed to learn about. So it was very much an exercise in first trying to learn what I didn't know. Right? I didn't even know what to try to learn at first. That's still the case to a certain extent. And that made it really intriguing, you know. Shoot, we were we started the business in 2007. The nice thing is that we didn't sell our first bottle of wine until 2010. So we had a lot of time to figure out everything in between. But it was very much a process in figuring out what we were supposed to know and then trying to learn that. Digging through the whole branding process was far more complicated than I wanted it to be. I always kind of thought that there was going to be this magical brand that just dropped out of the sky and bonked me on the head, and that was the name of our business. I had a couple of those, but turns out they were such good names, they'd already been trademarked. So we had to go through this whole long process of just grinding at it to try to come up with a good brand. It's pretty funny though. I have the book now that we started with our marketing company. I think we had 2,000 names that we had boiled it down to, and somewhere like buried in the middle of like the bottom, I guess the bottom right corner, like page 3 or page 4, is this little word Double Back, which now it's sort of like when you name your kids. Once you name your kids, that's their name. That's it.
You know? Yep.
But when we were going through that process, it was much harder, much more involved than that.
Do you think your experience as a football player, like when you went from high school to college, I imagine there was a steep learning curve. And then when you went from college to Bill Parcells, there's another learning curve. Was any of that translated in terms of just your work ethic and figuring out now this learning curve that you had to do back in the mid to late 2000s?
Well, I think at a high level, there are so many translations from my life and experience as a football player into business, and specifically the wine business. I think particular to the learning aspect of it, I think that was a big part of it, because as a football player, you are always problem solving. You're problem solving during the off season, trying to figure out what you're going to be the next year, trying to be problem solving in training camp, problem solving during the week. And then you're trying to figure out what you did wrong the week before and how you can fix that going forward. And so you're perpetually, trying to learn and get better all the time as a football player. And I think, you know, that certainly has served me well and served our business well, now, because we, you know, it's sort of one of those, you know, we certainly are readily acknowledging that we don't know everything yet. And we're readily acknowledging that we probably have made some mistakes. We actually just was on a call this morning when we were trying to do it earlier with our president and with our marketing gal. And we were talking through a couple of specific issues where we haven't done things right, and we're trying to figure out and solve them going forward. So I think that quality of admitting where you're wrong and trying to fix it rather than trying to pretend like something wasn't wrong and gloss over it as something that's very specific to sports.
Yeah, no, and both wine and sports, wildly, wildly humbling, you know, because you don't have any, you know, only so much control. I've seen at the LCBO, every now and then, your wines pop up. I've seen some of your double back Cabernet Sauvignon. Mm-hmm. But I was wondering if you could just tell the listeners a little bit more about Walla Walla. And, I mean, I've certainly in the area tried some killer Syrahs. Cayuse is one that always sticks out for me. But just the Bordeaux varietals, the Syrahs, what makes where you're making wine, what makes that area so special?
Yeah, no, it's a perfect setup. You know, one of my favorite people in the world of wine, Ken Wright, one of the founding fathers of the Willamette Valley and Pinot. I've done a couple of events with him, and he has, that's, you know, one of the ways I've learned in the wine, but I just plagiarize everybody else. And so Ken Wright's statement that he said a lot of different times is that, he says, you know, there's certain places in the world where things just grow differently. You know, you go to a specific part of Italy and the tomatoes taste different there than they taste any place else in the world. And you can't replicate it. At least so far, you can't replicate it. Well, wine is definitely that way. You know, there are certain places in the world where wine grapes just grow differently. And we know the names of all those places. It's Bordeaux, it's Burgundy, it's Piedmont, it's Tuscany, you know, Napa, I guess. you know, the Willamette Valley of Oregon, you know, you got Paso Robles is a great new spot in California. But Walla Walla is definitely one of those places. And it's really about two things. It's about climate, it's about soil. And then you can also bring in, you know, your different aspects on different hillsides and so on that further exacerbate that. But what we have in the Walla Walla Valley, we have an amazing palette of different soils, and the geology of our valley is really interesting. I was laughing earlier. We were doing a virtual wine tasting last week, and I was pointing out to him that when I was in college, the one geology class I took, Geology 101, was lovingly called Rocks for Jocks because it's what all the athletes took to get their grades up.
Right? I thought it was communications.
Yeah, that one too, right? You know, but now that I'm in the wine business, well, now I'm kind of a geology nerd.
Yeah.
And the geology of our valley and of our region is actually captivating when you start to look into it. It starts millions of years ago with these massive lava flows. They actually think that the lava flows over the northwestern United States, I don't know, it's like 14, 15 million years ago, were the largest lava flows that they've discovered in the world. It's like most of the northwestern United States was covered with just these massive lava flows. And so we've got this bedrock of basalt, which is interesting because grapevines can actually penetrate fractured basalt and turn it into clay, which is just kind of cool to me that you get this plant that actually can break up rock. And then following that, probably what, like 30 or 40,000 years ago, we had the Missoula floods that came across the northwestern United States, where we had, during the ice age, we had an ice dam that formed this massive lake all the way up into British Columbia and Alberta, all the way, you know, up into Montana. And every, I don't know, 20 or 30 years, that ice dam would break, and we had these cataclysmic biblical floods that came down across the Northwest. And that deposited this really mineral rich and very deep porous soil. You know, now specific to the Walla Walla Valley, you know, allows us to have this amazingly fertile ground that's also very porous, and porous ground matters because the vines have to dig really deep for moisture. And then you combine that with a perfect grape growing climate, because we've got the Cascade Range that blocks all the rain. That's why it rains in Seattle all the time. On our side, it's a high desert. So you get these long, hot summer days. But then it still cools off really nicely at night. So you get good natural acidity in the wine, you get longer hang time, even though you get your fruit all the way ripe. And so you put all of those factors together in this one little spot in Walla Walla, and you can really make some magic.
That's cool. And by the way, I love the fact that now your education in school is translating. It's translating to now, which is fantastic. I also loved early in that answer, slight dig at Napa. I appreciated that. Do you think more people are coming to Washington State for their bigger full-bodied reds because, you know, it's just so expensive in Napa, in Sonoma, because of the cost of production, the cost of land? Not that where you are is cheap, but it's certainly there's more value where you are than there is in so much of California, where a $23 bottle of Cabernet, you know, there's going to be a lot of sugar and chemicals in it if it's from Napa.
Yeah. You know, and I, you know, I mean, I say that in jest, obviously.
Of course.
Napa, and it, you know, those were the first wines that I fell in love with, and we've got great friends down there, and people still making some amazing wines down there. I think a couple of things are happening specific to Napa. I think you're seeing some a movement in Napa back toward at least some level of restraint in the wine styles that they're making. Where for a while there, they just kept ratcheting things up. You know, higher alcohol, more extraction, more oak. You know, just more of everything. And I think that there's a little palate fatigue, I think, generally for people, certainly at the high end of the spectrum. And so what you're seeing in Napa is people going to the hillsides. People harvesting a little bit earlier, a little bit lower sugar, trying to make wines that are trying to achieve a little more balance. So you're seeing that happen in Napa. But in terms of people coming north, that really is happening. You know, first of all, I think just, you know, value aside, you know, look, we're not afraid to take the Pepsi challenge with anybody. And then when you factor in price, then we're absolutely kicking ass, because in order to, you know, to the extent that people care about scores, which I don't know that people care that much about scores anymore, but, you know, to have a Napa wine that has had the same average critical scores that Doubleback has had over the last decade, you're paying at least three times the price, and sometimes, you know, four, five, six times the price to get, you know, and, you know, I put some stock in particular critics, but not necessarily in scores broadly. And so when you put those things together, yeah, a lot of people are coming our way. One thing that I do think is cool about Walla Walla, and it's obviously marketing puffery a little bit, but I also think it happens to be true, is that in Walla Walla, you get the best of the new world combined with the best of the old world. And when I say that, you get that pretty bright new world fruit that you might expect coming out of California, but you also get some of the structure and acid that you would equate with Bordeaux. And when you put those things together, you know, you have something that's pretty unique.
Yeah. You'll find that with like a Willamette Pinot is going to sort of be in between California and Burgundy. I mean, unless you're in like the coldest parts of like the Petaluma Gap, you know, it's hard to get, you know, that good sort of cool weather Pinot from California. One little divergent for a second. You mentioned you did an event with Ken Wright and got my diploma for a diploma level for my WSET wine and all that kind of stuff. At the ceremony, I was in a room with Jancis Robinson, and my girlfriend didn't understand why I was so shy to go talk to her. She's a small woman, frumpy dressed. I'm like, I can't talk to her. It's Jancis. She's the biggest celebrity here. And I wonder, how weird is it for you? You're in a group of people, and maybe for the first time, if you're there with Ken Wright, for a lot of people, Ken Wright is a bigger celebrity than you are. And for so long, you know, in the sports world, you were a massive celebrity. Is it funny being in a room and right, Ken is next to you and more people might want to swarm him?
Yeah, no, it's cool too, because that's the world I'm in now. So, you know, and I'm the same, and I'm always trying to soak up the whatever I can. But yeah, the first time that happened was with Chris Figgins, who was our first winemaker, still a great friend. He was Josh McDaniel's mentor, who's now our winemaker. But Chris's dad started Leonetti Cellars, which is really the grandfather of Washington wine when it comes to, or the godfather of Washington wine when it comes to quality, started back in the 70s. That was me, and it was Rick Meyer. So we were the top two draft picks in 1993 in the NFL yep. draft. Still great friends. Rick's in the wine business also, has a winery called Mirror down in Napa, making actually some really killer wine, especially their Howell Mountain stuff is spectacular. But we were at a wine convention. We happened to be in Reno, and we went out to dinner, and Rick and I were fairly fresh out of the NFL. We're, like you say, kind of used to being, you know, the most famous people in the room, or at least among, you know, at least if somebody's going to ask for an autograph, it was going to be us. It wasn't going to be the winemaker. But we sat down at dinner and all of a sudden we realized that we're in a different world now, because nobody gave a shit that we were at the table. They all wanted to talk to Figgin, you know, and he's like, he's like 5'6", you know, just kind of a little dude. And man, they'd come over and they'd, you know, introduce myself and they would immediately just turn their back on me and talk to Figgin. It's like almost like rude. Like, wait a second, you know, you don't need to ask for my autograph, but you should at least acknowledge that I'm sitting here. Holy shit. So that was our first, you know, awakening to that deal. But I absolutely love that component to it. You know, people that are really serious about wine, they could really not care less. And matter of fact, probably works against me that I could throw a football.
Well, it's, yeah, I was thinking about that. I'm like, you being on my radio show, which is a sports station, you're the big get. On this podcast, you're still a big get. Like, it's really, and I really appreciate you taking the time. But I've had, like, for the people that listen, there's, you know, some winemakers in France and California, you know, they're the biggest celebrities.
Absolutely.
You mentioned before, like, when we were talking, that you came down, like a lot of people, with COVID. And my first thought was, I was hoping, A, that you were fine, that physically that you were okay, that this wasn't, you know, one of those like just really bad cases of it. But then my next thought, because this is wine, I was like, oh no, I hope Drew's sense of smell and taste are there, because wow, without those in your job, is that'd be devastating.
Oh, dude, it would suck, right? I actually talked to Josh, to our winemaker, and like on a very serious note. Like, dude, we might actually need to take out some insurance on your senses. And I'm being totally serious. You know, his sense of smell and taste. Now, you know, of course, there's the chemistry involved, and that's the science part of it. But these truly great winemakers, it's a combination of science and art. It's based on what they can taste and smell as well. And so we actually may do that. We may go see if we can get a, you know, Lloyd's of London underwriter to ensure his palate and his nose.
By the way, that's badass. Sorry to interrupt. That is badass. It's like, you know, I've got my sense of smell and taste is insured. That is cool.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, I Josh would think he was a pretty big friggin' deal if we do that, but, which he is a big deal, but to be honest with you, I think my smell and taste and, or my senses of taste and smell. Now I haven't really had much wine, to be honest with you, which is really odd for me, because it's really part of our daily life. But I did have a glass the other day. And the one thing that I noticed was I just, it honestly, just the wine, and it was a good glass of wine, it just kind of tasted sour. And so it was like, I just like almost was perceiving more just alcohol and acid and not as nuanced right now. My understanding is that, you know, if I am affected right now, everybody that I've talked to, it does come back. Sometimes it just takes a little while, but I think there are some isolated cases where people have lost their sense of taste and smell for forever. And that's where I think we probably need to go get Josh insured. Because if he loses that, we got to go find somebody that can replace at least that component of what he does.
Yeah. But your overall, you were saying before we started, you're feeling, you know, a little bit fatigued, but you're doing okay.
Yeah, doing great. Good. My daughter had it. She was the one that gave it to me. She just doesn't love me. She gave me COVID. we're all doing fine.
Good.
Slept a bunch. I slept like I was a 13-year-old for about 5 days, which was kind of interesting. I haven't slept that much since college, but other than that, really no symptoms.
Okay, that's all right. That's great to hear. So if people like a lot, you know, people listen to this podcast, I've seen the numbers. It's, you know, a variety of places, but a lot of them listen to this in Canada and in Southern Ontario and in Toronto. If people find your wines, and every now and then we find them at the LCBO, what can they expect? Like, if you were going to describe your wines, you know, how would you describe it?
Well, I think if I were to aim for one thing overall that we're trying to accomplish, balance in the way that we construct the wines. And when I say that, you know, we want bright fruit, but we also want tannin, we want structure, We want that, but that tannin, we don't want it. We don't want it to be overly harsh. We don't want it to be, and that's where I talk about, you know, old world. And so we do a lot to manage texture by managing our tannin every way we can from the vineyard all the way through the winemaking process. The wine is going to stand up to a variety, to a variety of foods. You grab a bottle of Doubleback, you don't just have to have a porterhouse. Because we've got good acid and good balance, we've actually had some wine dinners where they paired Doubleback with, some heartier fish, and it actually works, because it does have that balance to it. So I think that, what overall the experience with our wine, that what we're hoping for, and this is how, what I pursue when I'm buying other wines, is that it's a wine that's going to get more and more interesting the more time you spend with it. It's hopefully something that's pleasurable on your first sip. But over time, the wines that I pursue, that I buy from other people, are wines where my second glass is more interesting than the first. And by the time, I'm to that last sip, it's really a contemplative thing. And hopefully that's what we achieve with our wine, where initially, people are going to enjoy it, but then as they spend time with the wine, it's going to reveal itself, reveal layers and layers of complexity over time.
I don't want to ask you, is there one grape that you think really is the best one for your soil? It'd be like picking your favorite kid. Of course, right now you're not picking your daughter who gave you COVID, but is there something where you say, okay, all of our wines are good, and the Pinots we make in Oregon, like obviously you're going to stand up for all the wines, but is there one wine, is there one line of your wines where you say, if I had to give a customer one bottle, this is the best expression of what we're trying to do?
Well, first of all, you're right. It's really hard to do that. I will say though that our estate reserve that we started 3 years ago now, with the estate reserve, that's what you just described is essentially what we do with that wine. We watch all of the lot from the different vineyards, different blocks, different barrels, and so on as they go through the aging process, and we pick out our very best two or three barrels every single vintage now and bottle those under the estate reserve. So obviously super limited production, but I think that's a really special wine. And we bring enough wine into the building now with Doubleback and with Bledsoe Family and so on that we're able to be really selective and still maintain the overall quality of the other wines. On the geekier side, this last year with our wine club, with the Bledsoe Family Winery Wine Club, we released a little bit of Malbec that was just pure Malbec that we hadn't done in the past, and that seemed to really resonate with people enough so that we're probably going to build a brand around the Malbec now.
Really?
It's never going to be a big business driver for us, and honestly, the reason that we had that available was because in 2018, just stylistically, we didn't think the Malbec fit with Doubleback. And we do that purely blind year in and year out. Every other year, the Malbec's gone into the blend. And just stylistically, this last year, while the Malbec was amazing on its own, it didn't fit with the blend. And so then we had some Malbec, we bottled it on its own and really loved it. So that was pretty fun. And then our single vineyard Syrah stuff that we're doing under the Bledsoe McDaniels label, I think those wines are just magical, and I think they're going to get nothing but better over time. We've got the Rocks Syrah that we released this last year. We've got Flying Bee Vineyard, which is right at the winery, and then soon we'll be up on the very top of the hill up at and McQueen Vineyard with some single vineyard Syrah from up there. And those are really cool expressions of the place that they're grown.
That's as I said off the top, I love the Syrahs from the area that you're in. Two questions, one big, one small. The big one is, and it's not really that big, but for yourself, it's not that you feel, I'm not asking you feel fortunate, but the great thing about you, Drew, is you found that second act of your life. And I know for athletes, it can be hard. You have the routine of being a football player. It is your identity. And then when it ends, wow, it can sometimes just end. And, just the contrast. And now no one's paying attention to you and you don't have the schedule, but you've found the very successful second act. I imagine that you're rare. It's a very difficult thing for athletes to be able to find something as fulfilling as that high that you must have got as a professional athlete.
Yeah, no, you're spot on. It's a hard transition. It really is. And for a lot of reasons. You know, first of all, as an athlete, you know, for most guys, since you're really young, you've been kind of told that you're, you know, your shit don't stink. You know, you're kind of God's gift to the world from the time you're really young. And people treat you better and treat you different and all of that. And then if you're fortunate enough to, you know, to make it to the professional ranks, then you still have that adulation. And then you also have quite a bit of money in your pocket. And you have support around you. You know, you're told where to be, when to be there, what to eat, how to work out, you know, all of these things. So not only do you have all the trappings that go with it, you also have a very regimented schedule. So you don't really have to think about that part of it. For, you know, almost everybody, it ends before you think it's going to end. You know, I was one of the very rare few. I actually got to choose to retire rather than being shown the door and not being able to get a job. But that's very, very rare. And so when that whole thing comes to an end so suddenly, and it all stops at the same time, right? The money stops, the adulation stops, the schedule stops, you know, everything stops. And then you got to figure out what you're going to do with the rest of your life because you're generally pretty young. So it is a really hard thing. I do think that the particular to the NFL, their Players Association is doing a better job at educating guys on that transition and trying to help them through that process. You know, for me, I just took a look at guys that made the that transition successfully, and the ones that did it most successfully, they had something to do, something they were passionate about. And for me, that was wine, and it's been all of that. It's been a ton of fun.
Yeah, I mean, well, I can tell you've been doing it for so long. And even just the story about the Malbec, that shows you the passion right there. Because if it was just about the money, you're like, nope, Cabernet, you know, Chardonnay, Cabernet, those are the ones it's easier to sell. Malbec's a little bit trickier. Last question for you, Drew. I read this. What, and I'm going to mispronounce it, which is a shame. I'm part Italian. I've been to Piedmont twice. It's my favorite wine region in the world. What was the 1961 Giacomo Conterno? How Giacomo Conterno? I read that you had that bottle, you tried it. Do you remember it? I read that line. I'm like, damn, that would have been tasty.
Yeah. So the way that went down, we had a group of people in Walla Walla for a big wine event, and some of our friends had rented a house, and they invited me and Josh, and then our other buddies. Master sommelier who owns Gramercy Cellars in Walla Walla. They invited us over to come drink some wine with them. And I was late to the party because I'd been entertaining some people or whatever. And so I showed up and they had a whole bunch of these, 100 point Barolos on the table. It was just sort of over the top. But you know how when you walk into a room and you can just kind of tell there's something that everybody knows and you don't? Mm-hmm. Like everybody just kind of like doesn't want to make eye contact and, you know, like it's just sort of something uncomfortable. So finally, David, our buddy, gets up and he goes over to the table and he reaches behind this plant on the table and grabs this decanter. And everybody in the room goes, oh, you saved him a glass, because everybody didn't want to tell me that they just had the most amazing wine of their lives. And that I wasn't going to get any, right? And so he pours me a glass of 61 Conterno Barolo. And the interesting thing to me, and I think this is one of the things that is wine geeks that you pursue, is that these amazing wine experiences are really hard to put into words. And that's where, you know, that's the reason that art is called art, because it makes you feel something that you can't really describe in prose, right? And so this wine, first of all, it's, you know what I mean, at that point almost 60 years old, and it was just this ethereal experience that stayed with me, and it was still with me the next morning. It was just this magical combination of floral notes and tar and structure and leather and just like all of these things that just don't seem like they go together. But when they hit you, but the cool thing for me was that our buddy, who's a master sommelier, he's on the court of master sommeliers, one of the, you know, he's, you know, one of the kind of wine superheroes in the world. He was the youngest master sommelier ever in the world. And so I texted him the next morning. It's like, dude, I think that's the best glass of wine I've ever had in my life. And he goes, you know what? I was just thinking the same thing. When I flew back to Seattle this morning, I was still thinking about that wine. And so I was like, okay, well, that's cool. Greg thinks this wine's as cool as I thought it was. And so, yeah, it's sort of one of those things that then you have to pursue the rest of your life, unfortunately.
Yeah, unfortunately. And you're always pursuing it. And it's often pricey, but it's worth it if you can afford it. I fell in love because of an old brick orange Barolo myself. And I remember looking at the wine going, this looks gross. And then I took a sip and I started laughing. I'm like, oh my God, what the hell is going on here? But this is wonderful.
Right.
Yeah, Drew, tell people, where can people look up Doubleback? Where can they look up your wines?
Yeah, no, it's really pretty simple. You just go to doubleback.com and you can find us. And you also have there you can find our Bledsoe Family Winery offerings. There's a live shopping page on that page. We're currently, we just released about 3 or 4 weeks ago, the 2018 Doubleback wines. They're flying out the door. I do think it's probably our best vintage to date, which is cool. But yeah, doubleback.com, you can find us, and that'll also have links to the other wineries as well. Bledsoe McDaniel stuff that we released this last year. It's Willamette Valley Pinot Noir and single vineyard Syrah from the Walla Walla Valley. We only did about 150 cases of each of those wines this last year, and they sold out in 36 hours. So this year we're going to make a little bit more, but those are pretty special wines when they get released.
I really appreciate it. And again, congratulations on your success in two very difficult professions. One as a football player, and another as a winery owner. I think your story is really cool. And again, Drew, I appreciate you taking time to chat with me today. I think it's a really cool story you have.
Absolutely, man. My pleasure. And hopefully, we can get together in person and share a glass of wine before too long.
I would love to do it. I have this plan of going to a Soyuz in southern BC and then just driving south and doing Oregon and Washington. That's kind of what I want to do when the borders open. I would love to. So thank you again, Drew.
Yeah, right on, man. Sounds great.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.